Welcome to the Science, Microbes, and Health podcast, covering emerging topics and challenges in the fields of probiotics, prebiotics, synbiotics, postbiotics, and fermented foods. This is the podcast of the International Scientific Association for Probiotics and Prebiotics, known as ISAP, a nonprofit scientific organization dedicated to advancing the science of these fields. Check us out at www.isapscience.org. I'm Dr. Mary Ellen Sanders, ISAP's Executive Science Officer. I hope you enjoy this episode with your hosts from the ISAP Board of Directors, Professor Colin Hill and Professor Dan Tancredi.
Hi, everybody. My name is Colin Hill.
And I'm Dan Tancredi.
And we're here at the ISAP annual meeting in Sitges, beautiful Sitges. And we're joined by Katie Amato. Katie, can you tell us who you are and what you do, please?
Hi, yeah, thanks for having me. I am a professor in the Department of Anthropology at Northwestern University in the US, just outside of Chicago. And I study how gut microbes interact with non-human primate and human hosts from an evolutionary perspective.
So non-human primates. Are we talking monkeys? Are we talking gorillas? Can you give us some sense of how far out that family goes?
Absolutely. So all of the above, we are talking about non-human apes. So things like chimpanzees, bonobos, gorillas, orangutans, all the way through your monkeys, both in Asia and Africa, as well as Mexico, Central America, and South America. And then lemurs and other primates in the category strepsirrhine.
You know, you've made an extraordinary impact for such a young scientist, and your dissertation paper has been cited hundreds of times. Can you talk about the work you did in southeastern Mexico with the howler monkeys?
Absolutely. So that work was actually inspired by some of the early work in human biomedical studies and obesity. When I read those papers, and they showed that if you took microbes from an obese human and put them into a germ-free mouse, the mouse became obese. And they thought at that time that one of the mechanisms was that the microbes from an obese person were more efficient at producing compounds that the host could use as energy. And then there was a sentence that said, assuming the host doesn't need that energy, it will have to store it in the form of fat, which could contribute to weight gain. And I remember reading that as somebody coming from an ecological background and thinking, I never assume the host has sufficient energy. When I'm thinking about wild primates, I'm always thinking that they could use more energy, whether it's because of a season where there's less food availability or because of increased nutritional demands like pregnancy and lactation. And so I became really interested in trying to understand if you could see shifts in the gut microbiome in wild primates that were similar to the types of differences that you saw between, let's say, obese and lean people in a biomedical context, but that could actually be contributing to helping howler monkeys in Mexico survive periods of low food availability. And howler monkeys are a really interesting model for this question, because when there's fruit available in the forest, they will eat the fruit, they prefer it. But when there's less fruit available, they'll switch their diet over to a diet of almost completely leaves. And so that's a much harder to digest diet. It's higher in fiber, higher in plant toxins. And for a long time, people asked how howler monkeys could be surviving off of this quote unquote low quality diet. And so looking into the gut microbiome in that context and whether it could be helping buffer the howler monkeys against those diet shifts was a really kind of cool way to get at that question. And so I went out and I followed howler monkeys around for a year, catching poop out of the trees and writing down everything that they were eating and taking behavioral data. And I found exactly that the howler monkeys had gut microbial shifts that occurred across seasons that were associated with changes in their diet, both in terms of the types of foods they were eating, fruits or leaves, but also in terms of the estimated macronutrient intake, specifically caloric intake. So when they were ingesting fewer calories, they could metabolize themselves. We were actually seeing a bigger short-chain fatty acid output in the fecal samples, and activity was staying the same. So indirect evidence that these microbes were actually compensating for their changes in diet over time.
I loved how you accounted for different habitats, and you saw these between habitat differences too.
Yeah, so that was another interesting question was, you know, these howler monkeys, because they can eat a leafy diet, can often persist in forest fragments longer than other primate species because they don't need the big fruit trees that disappear when you start to cut the forest down. And so that was another hypothesis that these monkeys in forest fragments were relying really heavily on their gut microbiome to be able to survive there and that their microbiomes would be more efficient. But we actually didn't see that when we went and sampled howler monkeys in these fragmented forests. We actually saw reduced gut microbial diversity, reduced potential for short-chain fatty acid production and increased prevalence of potential pathogens. And so it seems that, you know, there may be this kind of flexibility in the howler monkey gut microbiome that helps them deal with changes in diet across seasons. But perhaps when your habitat change is kind of larger and maybe happens on a shorter time span, then you disrupt the ability of the microbiome to kind of adapt and you're actually negatively affecting the microbiome as well.
Do you study at all what happens if these non-human primates move into, I suppose, the equivalent of a modern setting for humans, like a zoo or an animal park or something where they don't forage for themselves and maybe food is more plentiful? Do they experience the same issues that humans do? And what, does it have impacts on their microbiome?
Generally speaking, yes. So generally speaking, primates that you have in captivity tend to have lower gut microbial diversity and some of the other sorts of shifts in microbial taxa and functional potential that we see associated with kind of industrialization in humans. Not completely to the same extent, but we do see that. And it also depends on the primate species and their diet in particular. So primates that have a more specialized diet in the wild, like leaf eaters, have a much more dramatic change in their microbiome when you bring them into captivity, presumably because it's harder to keep their diet similar to what it would be in the wild. Whereas primates that are kind of more omnivorous in the wild, you see some shifts in the microbiome in captivity, but not to the same degree.
So you've kind of looked at how challenges to, you know, getting nutrition have altered how the physiology of ourselves and our cousins, you know, in the ape world. Can you talk about your latest hypothesis where you posit that fermentation to try to improve access to nutritional components in food might have been an evolutionary impetus?
Absolutely. So this was a fun rabbit hole that I would say I went down the past couple of years. So I was asked for another workshop put on by the Wenner-Gren Foundation, which is an anthropological foundation, to think about and write about the evolution of the consumption of fermented foods. So being somebody that is, you know, part microbiome researcher, part primatologist, I thought I would start with wild non-human primates and trying to understand, you know, how often you see fermented food consumption in wild primates currently, and how that compares to what we see in humans. In the sense that it wouldn't compare necessarily, because you see fermented food consumption in pretty much every human population across the globe to some extent, right? And generally speaking, we don't think we see that in wild non-human primates, but nobody had really gone through and tried to quantify that. So with the help of a couple other primatologists, I reached out to a very large number of field primatologists, some who work at study sites across the globe, and ask them, you know, qualitatively, how often do you see your primate species consuming what we would call kind of overripe fruit, right? We didn't have the chemical assays to say this is fermented and to what degree, but, you know, did something look like it was kind of overripe and fermented? And so we ended up getting data from 40 species of primates at 50 sites at four continents across the globe. And 15 of those species at 23 sites were reported to be consuming overripe fruits at some point during the year. And so it was much more prevalent than I think anybody expected. And what was also interesting is that it seemed to be linked to fruits that were defended otherwise. So either had high secondary metabolite content or had a high fiber content. And so perhaps the primates wouldn't be able to consume them unless they were fermented, since fermentation breaks down those fibers and it can detoxify some of those compounds. So it was something like 3/4 of the fruits that were being consumed, at least qualitatively, looked like they would be harder to eat if they weren't fermented.
Well, you contrasted that nicely with the drunken monkey hypothesis. Like, you don't think it's just going for ethanol.
Yeah.
So can you talk about that?
Yeah. So I guess the other key thing was that we saw that this happened more often in habitats where there was higher maximum average temperatures and lower average rainfall. And so it seemed to be associated with climate, which also could be associated with plants kind of trying to defend themselves, or with habitats where it's harder to find food.
Or seasonal fluctuations.
Or seasonal fluctuations, exactly. And so when I kind of step back and start to think about this in an evolutionary sense, when we think about human fermented food consumption, oftentimes it's linked to the archaeological record in that, you know, we needed the like containers to be able to store for food to ferment it over time. But if you actually look at the biological data, we have genes that would be associated with the consumption of fermented food that are 10 million years old. And so that's way earlier than we had the technology to like save food. And there are some instances of people finding like fish bones in a pit or fruits in a cave where they, you know, were probably stored to be fermented there. So you don't necessarily need technology to do this. And it looks like this was happening a long time ago. So the ADH4 gene, which increases our ability to metabolize ethanol. And then there is an HCA gene, which increases our ability to essentially communicate with lactobacillus bacteria, which is also 10 million years old. And so if you take that together with the primate data from the way that, you know, extant primates are consuming fermented food, it seems that perhaps this could have been a strategy for our very early human ancestors to be able to access foods they wouldn't be able to access otherwise in the environment. And you could imagine it happening through human ancestors, perhaps, you know, coming upon fermented foods in the environment, since we know fruit ferments spontaneously, often in the environment. If they could find those sorts of foods and consume them, that would have given them a food resource they wouldn't have access to otherwise, and could have actually helped humans expand their habitat. I think this is particularly interesting when we think about humans moving from more like forest environments into open woodland environments, because we think they started to consume more underground plant storage organs, so things like tubers, which we know tend to be high in toxins and often, not always, but often have to be processed through either mechanical process or fermentation to be consumed. And so you can imagine that there could have been kind of a technological advance where, you know, perhaps early humans were consuming these foods when they found them, or fermenting them kind of by accident because something got left out in the right conditions. And then we started to perhaps develop the technology over time, which could have allowed us to live in these environments where it's harder to find food.
It's non-human primates. I know, I presume you can't give them an IQ, or you can't put an exact value, or maybe you can. Is there any evidence at all that there's any intent or purpose, that they would take a food and bury it or put it somewhere and come back to it once it has fermented? Or do you think it's all adventitious, just coming across a food that's already overripe?
So that's a great question. And the super interesting thing about the non-human primate study we did is that there were a few instances of that sort of thing happening. And the primatologists were, with reason, very cautious to say that it was kind of conscious intent. But there were three different species of primates, a lemur species, a spider monkey, and then capuchins, so both New World primates, that were shown to knock fruits out of the trees. And in the case of the spider monkey and the lemurs, they would eat fruits that either had been on the ground and had kind of become overripe and fermented, or the ones in the trees, but they appeared to prefer the ones that were on the ground. The capuchins consumed these fruits that had a really hard outer kind of husk or shell, and they couldn't eat them unless they had been fermented, essentially. And so the person, her name's Dr. Liz Malott, she observes these capuchins knocking these fruits out of the trees, leaving, coming back 3 weeks later, and then eating them off the ground. So I do think there's some evidence that that sort of thing could be happening in extant primates, and therefore certainly could have been happening in our human ancestors.
Which innovation do you think would have come first? Using fermented foods or heat? Using heat to process foods or to preserve them, or salt to preserve them, things like that.
It starts to get hard because we're going so far back in evolutionary history that it's difficult to have material evidence of either fermentation or cooking. But I will say that the genes that we have that are associated with fermented food consumption are older than our oldest estimates of the beginning of cooking.
By quite a bit in your paper.
Yes, by quite a bit. So I think all of these things probably contributed to humans' ability to kind of expand their dietary niche and evolve to have these large, energetically expensive brains. But I suspect fermented foods is a really good candidate for something that could have happened first, because you need so little technology and it looks like it's showing up so early in our DNA.
Can you go back to that? One of the beautiful things about studying things in evolutionary time is that you can address things like our brains did get bigger. And so we might have used fermentation to overcome these physical and chemical defenses in grasses and then husk, you know, bound food. So that must be something kind of exciting for you that you don't have to think about it as, was this a monkey smart enough to deliberately ferment, but that there's sort of a feedback.
Yeah, no, and I think it's really interesting to think about it from that perspective, because that's one of the big questions in human evolution is how could we possibly support this metabolically expensive large brain? And for a long time, the leading explanation has been that we shifted our diet to make it more digestible, and kind of which came first is always a question, right? But that our diets became more digestible because we started cooking and eating more meat, and that our intestine therefore could shrink because we didn't need to do so much microbial fermentation. And that as a result, because the intestine is just as metabolically expensive as the brain, or it's the next most expensive thing, we therefore could put energy into our brains as opposed to in the intestine. And so I think thinking about fermented food, perhaps triggering that process as opposed to just cooking, is a really interesting way to kind of think about human evolution and kind of what technological, biological processes could have actually kind of contributed to that.
But you also take advantage of the genome and show that some of the old world monkeys have some of these genes.
Yeah, I was going to say the other really interesting thing. So I hadn't thought about a lot of this, and I find it fascinating now. And a lot of it's hard to test. And so I'll throw that out there as a challenge so people can try to figure out better ways to test some of this. But the other primate species that evolved in similar environments, which are these kind of open woodland environments, also appear to have these mechanisms of what I would call predigestion. So I argue that because, you know, we started to reduce fat size and have our food became easier to digest, it was not necessarily because of something physiological, but perhaps technological, that we are predigesting our food through fermentation and eventually intentional fermentation, but perhaps just intentional consumption of fermented foods early on. You also have cercopithecines, which are old world monkeys, things like baboons and macaques. They have these cheek pouches. And they've been studied primarily in the context of feeding competition. So like, you know, imagine a chipmunk and you can run out and like pick up as many acorns as you can and shove them in your mouth and go kind of eat it in your hole. But what's really interesting about these cheek pouches is they have a huge amount of enzymatic activity.
In other words, saliva to break down the starches.
Yeah, exactly. And so there are all of these anecdotal accounts of people finding, you know, if one of these monkeys was found dead or back in the day hunted, and they would find seeds in these cheek pouches. And so it's really hard to see a seed go in and out of a cheek pouch. But presumably these primates are using their cheek pouches to pre-digest these hard to digest foods to perhaps kind of serve the same function as us fermenting. And then the other group of primates is also an old world monkey. These are the colobines. They have a sacculated foregut, kind of like a rumen, but it's much less efficient than a rumen. It doesn't have as many compartments, and there's not kind of the mixing dynamics that happen in the rumen. So it's also been suggested, however, that that's a pre-digestion mechanism. So there's still digestion that has to happen in the large intestine, but you're getting this kind of pre-digestion. And those primates also kind of were in these open woodland environments that would have been nutritionally difficult.
You said the beautiful work that Turnbull and Gordon and those did, showing that you could transfer obesity through the microbiome into a mouse in a germ-free mouse on a high-fat diet. Are there reverses? Are there things we can learn by studying microbiomes of non-human primates that we could transfer back? You know, obviously they're much closer to us than mice or rats or...
Yeah, so I think there's a few ways I like to think about this. So first, in the context of this fermented food work, I think it's really interesting to think about, you know, maybe fermented foods are not just beneficial to health, but maybe they've been essential to our health and biological processes across evolution, which I think, if not subtly, somehow, you know, I think that changes our perspective of how we should be thinking about fermented foods. Not that this is kind of an add-on, but perhaps it's a necessity that has been taken out of some of the industrialized diets, and that we should be thinking really seriously about, you know, this is not just like a supplement. This is like, should be part of the diet. And then I think in terms of some of the other work with kind of diet and non-human primates more broadly, I think they can be used as models to some extent. So like the howler monkeys, trying to understand what kind of the evolved relationships are between microbes and their hosts in natural environments where there's selective pressure acting and where microbes could actually be kind of more day-to-day influencing the survival of the primates? What are those kind of relationships? And then what are the environmental shifts, whether it's diet or kind of the built environment that could be, you know, changing those environments and then altering those relationships? And then the last thing that we've been doing in the lab to some extent that I also find really interesting is comparing the human microbiome to the non-human primate microbiome, not only to try to find similarities, but I think it's also important to look for differences and try to understand how the human microbiome might be unique. Because if there are things that are characteristically human that we see in humans over and over and over again that we don't see in other non-human primates, I think those are really interesting targets for trying to think about kind of maybe those have an evolutionary purpose and therefore are important in terms of health. And a little bit of the work that we've done there has actually pulled up the microbial taxa that some of the biomedical studies are pulling out as potentially important for health. So Faecalibacterium presidensis looks like it's characteristic of humans compared to other non-human primates. Bacteroides fragilis, Helicobacter pylori, you know, these are things that come up in the health literature repeatedly. And so to see those being things that are potentially characteristic of humans, I think gives us another clue as to, you know, how important they might potentially be.
And then things like colonization resistance, are non-human primates more resistant to infection? I can imagine that they must eat a lot more contaminated things and get exposed a lot more to pathogens. Is that true? Or do you think there's a better colonization resistance in these microbiomes that you're studying?
That's a great question. I would suspect that potentially they are, but I don't think we have the data on that. You know, and I don't have the data on this either, but I've thought about it, you know, in the context of human evolution, the microbiome potentially allowing us to migrate into different dietary niches that we wouldn't have been able to inhabit otherwise. But I think that could also be true in terms of kind of infectious disease landscapes, right? As we migrated across the globe, we were coming into contact with all sorts of different pathogens that we hadn't come into contact with before. And so I think, again, yeah, like you said, comparing those between humans and non-human primates and also thinking about it in humans over time would be really interesting, but I'm not aware of data on that.
And studying non-human primates, is that very ethically challenging? I mean, you know, we have an empathy with non-human primates that we might not have with mice or rats or, you know, zebrafish or whatever, but that yet, of course, they can't give consent. So is it an ethically challenging field?
Yeah, so I think it can be, especially with captive work, and that it depends on the type of study being done. With the wild primates, I don't find it ethically challenging. There may be others who would opine differently, but the majority of what I do is non-invasive. So we're literally following the primates, observing them from a distance, picking up poop, catching urine out of the trees.
There's a big ethical challenge that you've been, along with other scientists, involved in too. Can you talk about like the importance of trying to address these threats to the survival of the non-human primates?
Yeah, so that is an issue kind of more broadly within the suite of, you know, climate change and anthropogenic influences on the environment more broadly. And so I do think, you know, thinking about, are we just trying to get data out of these non-human primates, or are we doing something to also ensure the survival of the species, is a really important ethical question. And I think it's something that most primatologists struggle with in terms of, you know, what you get rewarded for in academia are the data and the papers and the grants and not the conservation work necessarily. But without the conservation work, we won't have these species to study any longer. And so I think we do need to do a better job as a field of kind of putting the conservation work more on the same playing field as the rest of the science. And I know there's a lot of great primatologists out there that are doing a lot at the community level to engage communities that are around the field sites where the primates are being studied, that are also trying to make kind of impacts more broadly, kind of globally in terms of understanding these issues. But it's often right now kind of a person by person effort, which can be difficult when you're trying to run a research agenda as well. So,
well, as for an assistant professor, the bibliometric impacts you've had by how many times your papers have been cited have been impressive, but it's also impressive how many times you've won mentoring awards. So can you talk about like your experience with mentoring and also like some of the great teachers that have mentored you?
Absolutely. So I am grateful to so many mentors throughout my career. And so I have a long list of people, but I'll kind of go through it generally. I think it you know, I was always interested in biology, but John and Jim Burnside were my high school biology teachers in kind of two different classes, brothers. And they were some of the most engaging, enthusiastic teachers I've ever had, who really made me feel like, no, this is my thing. Like, I thought I liked biology, but I know I like.
And that was at the famous New Trier High School in Chicago. Yes. Lands.
Yes, it was. And then moving forward into college, at Dartmouth College, the whole biology department did a great job of supporting me. There's kind of the ecology contingent. So Kathy Cottingham, Matt Ayers, David Peart, John Gilbert, Mark McPeak, and Craig Lane, who taught me how to design ecological studies and actually do good scientific writing. Mm-hmm. And then my advisor there, Bob McClung, who gave me kind of my first chance at long-term research in his lab, working on the genetics of circadian rhythms in Arabidopsis thaliana, which now looking back was super useful because it taught me how to extract DNA and sequence DNA, and that was something I could use immediately in my PhD. Steve Rosseling Park Zoo and Alejandro Estrada at La Universidad Nacional Autónoma de México gave me my first shot at primate research, and I'll always be grateful for that. And then, of course, in graduate school, my advisor, Paul Garver, who does not do lab work at all. And so kind of pointed me in the direction of microbiome research, which was just starting to explode, and continued to be my advisor, but started every sentence always with, I don't know anything about microbes, but here's my question. And they were always these great ecological and evolutionary questions. And then people like Angela Kent, Rod Mackey, and Steve Lee, who like let me work in their labs and learn all the techniques. And then lastly, Rob Knight and Steve Lee, who were my postdoc advisors and let me be a really independent postdoc, but also provided me all this professional networking support. So every single one of those people was important. So it's a long list, but you know, that's how we get to where we are, in my opinion.
Takes a village.
Yes.
Katie, that was fascinating. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much.
Thanks so much, Katie. That was wonderful.